our environment, our people, and our lands.
James, can you tell me more about Digital Link? Or Indigilink, sorry. Indigilink Digital.
Yeah, thanks. It's a company I started quite a few years ago, and it was a research company on Indigenous blockchain. And really, it's kind of weird because it's not quite normal to say Indigenous blockchain, but it's the research that has to take place. I firmly believe that we still need to, for early adoption, we have a long way to go, but we need to do the research. And so my company does that, and I've been doing that for a very long time, since the birth of the internet, quite honestly. But what it means is that that research is critical to tangible actions, tangible projects, pilot projects, if you will, that are going to maybe have that transition of that technology, that's going to have the Indigenous lens. So that was the whole idea behind the work of that research.
So Ethan, you also have a tech company, Nations First Technologies. How is it different from James's?
So Nations First is, we focus on working with First Nations. We built a blockchain network, an entirely independent blockchain network, where we tokenize, again, making those digital twins of these natural resources, the energy assets, the ecosystem, so all the biodiversity, carbon, soil, water, etc., and addressing issues like investment into our projects, into our resource projects, and you know, that ultimately trickles down into the community, and you know, just providing them with the dignity of a home and services within their community and that sort of work. And so while also protecting the community from predatory investment that may
threaten. Can you give me some examples of what you're talking about?
Yeah, so, you know, oftentimes we see major, you know, resource developers come in and totally bypass the community, or, you know, they might make predatory investments into the community, threatening its sovereignty or its title to its land. And so we've designed a system that makes very clear compliance within the nation, very clear investment into the projects. And, you know, everything is audited by the community. And so, you know, we're very niche, but we also are working in quite a legacy industry and large space.
Okay, that's great. Carolyn, you created Indigenomics Institute, and you identified the potential value of the Indigenous community economy in Canada at more than $100 billion. That's a lot. So how did you come up with this number?
The first centering of a potential of the Indigenous economy was based on if the Indigenous population is close to 5% of the total population. If we were a generative Indigenous economy, it would equate to about 5% of the total, would be about $100 billion. And while that number was identified within 2019, which at the time the valuation was around $32 billion, the escalation of the continued demonstration of Indigenous economic value and how that is happening is essentially shifting the way we understand Indigenous economic activity and our participation within the larger Canadian economy.
Okay, so tell me more about your company.
So the Indigenomics Institute is a financial technology company. We do modern Indigenous economic design. We look at a platform that identifies how we describe ourselves as Indigenous economic powerhouses and how we center our relationship in the Canadian economy as both legal and economic. And while there's a weighted demonstration of that on the legal side, the expression of that on the economic side is essential to begin to bring value to. If we look in the historical structure of the Indian Act, the intention was never for Indigenous peoples to have an economy. And it exists to this day that the absence of Indigenous economic participation is built into the Indian Act itself. And while we have many nations who are across many different definitions, whether that's historical treaty, modern treaty, different variations of self-government or identification, it's essential to understand that every single person within this country, from the beginning until now, whether newcomers or longer settlers, that every single person in this country has been negatively and continues to be negatively impacted by the Indian Act. So what our work at the Institute is doing is focusing on framing that impact, framing generative Indigenous economic activity, describing how we create value specifically because of who we uniquely are as having rights within this country. And we are building an Indigenomics AI system to demonstrate in a powerful way an increase of the evolution of Indigenous economic activity, but also moving that beyond GDP and looking at how is value creation happening, how do we look at that demonstration of how we do business, as well as the larger impact of that. So building an Indigenomics AI economic intelligence platform to really think about how we think about economic intelligence, what we know as Indigenous people, and coming back to what you were speaking of, that how do we build that from our values, and how do we build that from the leadership of what our responsibilities are as Indigenous people?
What, Caroline, what is your view on, you know, First Nations people, Indigenous people, using AI to protect our many dying languages?
I think that it's a beautiful tool that's presenting itself in front of us at this time. And it's a powerful tool. And our ability to see its capabilities, our ability to not have it be an answer for us, but in our toolbox of everything that we put in that toolbox, of whether that's our rights or whether that's our stewardship practices or our data governance or any of those aspects, our ability to utilize that tool in a powerful way that stems from our core values as people in terms of respect and caring for and future generations and abundance that's based in sustainability. When we can build and design from that place of power, that's that transmission of those teachings across time and those responsibilities, this represents a powerful moment of our ability to shift away from that story and experience of what's happened to us to move towards design bias. And that's the opportunity that technology provides us today as Indigenous people, both in business and in nation building.
You said, you said to Canadians, get ready. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the primary foundation of our work in Canada, while that's focused on the construct of $100 billion, how do we demonstrate that through data analysis? How we demonstrate that through economic reconciliation outcomes? It was during the pandemic that I started tracking kind of projects over the billion-dollar level, whether that was investment or land value or whatever those aspects within the economic development realm were. And it became quickly to my realization that the escalation of economic value was something that needed to be paid attention to. And with the first version of Indigenomics AI, we were easily able to identify $100 billion of Indigenous economic activity. And while Statistics Canada or the federal government are currently valuing the Indigenous economy at around $50 billion, to understand actually the true value of the projects and the investments, the assets, the combination of those to really understand a larger perspective of value and impact. The concept of get ready is we're well beyond $100 billion, and that what allowed us to respond to the Indigenous and legal relationship, for example, at $32 billion or $50 billion, what we're looking at right now is economic power. And we're looking at Indigenous resilience and how that expresses through our ability to pick up technology to get ready means that we're looking at the next $100 billion of Indigenous economic activity with AI as a tool that supports our stewardship responsibilities within our territories, our governing systems, and our economies. And that's a powerful combination that supports our return to our ability to make decisions about our future.
What about AI do you see as a negative?
I think that where I'm most intrigued is while we consistently hear about the amount of water usage that's critical in the deployment of AI, I think that where we see less conversation is who is innovating in that space. And I think that the emergence of Indigenous data centers is going to be a critical trend in the Indigenous economy, in Indigenous governance, and Indigenous conservation practices. And our ability to focus on innovation and the partnerships that lead with the values of what is possible, I think Indigenous innovation around data centers will in itself, our perspective and worldview, I think it is a critical moment of the energy usage and water usage specifically, but I think our ability to be at the table and to be at the partnerships and to be present in the innovation is essential.
Would you say that, your tech companies are helping us take our space in this society?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, take it back, like, you know, because of the reserve system in Indiana.
Yeah, in my first book, I used that example of the metaphor of taking our seat at the economic table. And that doesn't mean their economic table. It means our ability to sit in our seat of our responsibility, our ability to govern, our ability to operate from our worldview. And every time Indigenous peoples win a legal case, we win it in the courtroom and it's expressed in the economy. And nobody is making room for us at the table. We're systematically, case by case, defining our modernity. We're case by case representing our belonging in this moment, in our own future. And to understand the inheritance of that legacy that denied us that space, it didn't just deny us the space at the economic table. This system denied our space in our own future. And I think that the resilience that we show up in this moment, having a conversation in this generation about the possibility of technology, about how we step back into our responsibilities with it, I think is a powerful, beautiful moment that we're in.
Yeah, that's so true.
All right, that is most of the panel Indigenous Wisdom Meets Emerging Technology from Web Summit Vancouver, featuring Ethan Clark, Carol Ann Hilton, and James DeLorme, chaired by Donna Sound, here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I was really lucky to be able to attend that conference. I'm glad I did, and glad I got to share a little bit of that experience with you. Now for the end of the show, we are going to turn to a report from CJSF's very own Danny Nesvedarani, an interview with Chris Buse about transportation futures and air pollution, right now.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. Researchers at Simon Fraser University and the University of British Columbia are working in collaboration with Civic Innovation Lab, TransLink, Evo CarShare, and Mobi BikeShare to identify potential transit futures in the city of Burnaby, primarily trying to identify how the future transportation landscape of the city can work towards reducing air pollution within the region. The research project is titled Community-Based Alternative Urban Transportation Decarbonization Pathways and Co-Benefits for Climate Resilience, Air Quality, Health, and Equity. As the name clearly suggests, this research project is covering a lot of ground, and currently it involves a series of community workshops throughout Burnaby where residents of the city are able to share their opinions on transportation in their neighborhoods. To learn more about the project's current findings, CJSF attended one of these workshops, where we were able to get in contact with Chris Busey, assistant professor of health sciences at SFU and co-principal investigator for the project. After the workshop, we sat down for a conversation with Busey, where we spoke on some of the project's key findings, potential outcomes, and how people living in Burnaby can still provide their input on transit policy within the region.
And I'm here today representing a team of researchers from multiple institutions, both Simon Fraser University, University of British Columbia, but also our colleagues at the Civic Innovation Lab, which is a partnership between SFU and the City of Burnaby, TransLink, Mobi, and Evo. And so we've all kind of come together with this goal of exploring how is it that we get people out of their cars and into their community, and how do we do that in ways that keep people moving? So this project is really about exploring different alternative scenarios, specifically for the City of Burnaby, with this very, very particular goal of reducing single vehicle kilometers traveled, or VKT. So how do we electrify our fleets to improve air quality? How do we also shift people's attitudes away from driving into micromobility, like riding and rolling, riding bikes or rolling scooters across town, versus taking public transit, right, as an affordable and available option.
And where is the research project at the moment? What are some of the key findings?
There's kind of four different work packages in this project. We've got a group out of UBC Okanagan that's working on something called an agent-based model. And so what they're trying to figure out is how do people currently move across the city of Burnaby? What's their typical mode? What does that look like in terms of time spent on the road, going from various locations that we all visit in our day-to-day realities? So work, school, recreation, shopping, you name it. That group is then kind of sharing that what we understand about how people move across the city of Burnaby with a second group of folks that's then asking the question, what's the implication for air quality, right? What are the choices that people make? How does that actually influence concentrations of things like particulate matter and ground level ozone and nitrous oxides, things that can be really harmful for human health? And then our third PA is actually thinking about that from that kind of health modeling perspective. So really saying, okay, well, based on those emissions, what can we reasonably anticipate? How is this going to translate into things like emergency department visits, respiratory health conditions, and so on and so forth? And where we're at in the project right now is we've kind of taken that first pulse of data collection, that first pulse of analysis, and we're now bringing it back to communities to help us make sense of those models, help us make sense of some of those kind of core findings, and really start to identify opportunities where we might be able to kind of influence or nudge people's behavior towards more sustainable modes of transportation. And the thing that I want to impress upon you, Danny, and your listeners is, you know, this is a huge issue for Canada. We know that transportation, it's the second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, so it plays a really significant role in terms of climate change here domestically, but also internationally. We know that those emissions have grown about 33% from 1990, right? So we're actually not moving in the right way. We're seeing more and more electrification, but those emissions aren't actually decreasing yet. And we also know that because of the primacy of gas-powered and diesel-powered automobiles on our streets, adverse air quality events are a significant and leading cause of mortality. We anticipate, or Health Canada's modeled out, that we see about 14,600 premature deaths every single year attributable to adverse air quality in Canada. So this is a really significant issue, not only from kind of a sustainability perspective, but also from a human health and well-being perspective.
Mm-hmm. And you said that one of the organizations involved with this research project is Evo Carshare. Are car sharing cars also a part of that KVT number that you had mentioned previously?
Yeah, so we've kind of released a survey to Burnabites. We had a mail-out survey that reached about 30,000 people across the city. And we asked them about their typical trip. So it's almost like compiling a trip diary. How did you get around, and what's your most selected mode of transportation? And so there we invited people to provide a whole host of information about how they get around, ranging from, again, single automobile trips to public transit, to cycling, to walking, to rolling, to car share, to ride hailing with things like Uber and Lyft. And other, we also invited people to kind of self-define how they get around if they didn't take any of those modes, and we wanted to learn about those. So car sharing is definitely one of these opportunities where we're starting to see, you know, Evo as an organization spread out into more and more parts of Burnaby. It doesn't have complete coverage of the city yet, but we are seeing that it's being introduced as a really unique opportunity to enhance or at least reduce vehicle kilometers traveled, particularly in high density locations like apartment buildings, right, where you've got this opportunity to maybe restrict parking a little bit and really enhance the ability to share a single vehicle, for example, rather than having to own one and pick up all those maintenance costs and all the associated costs of using an automobile. So car sharing, definitely part of the mix. Bike sharing, also part of the mix. Public transit was kind of the second highest modal share from our survey. So people said, you know, typically I use cars to get around the city. Transit is kind of a second choice or the second most popular option. And then those, you know, the other mixes of transportation from cycling to walking to car share, ride share, et cetera.
From the survey and the community workshops that you've been hosting, have there been any sort of prevailing opinions or findings that have surprised the team?
Well, I don't know if it was surprising, but I mean, the survey definitely indicates the primacy of gas-powered automobiles as the kind of principal way of getting around Burnaby. So that's probably not going to surprise anyone in the city of Burnaby. But I think what we were kind of curious about, we asked a whole bunch of attitudinal questions to really figure out, like, how are people making discrete choices around how they get around? And what are the kind of levers that we could potentially pull on to encourage people to take, you know, more sustainable mobility options and make that a reality? And so some of the things that we're hearing right now from community members, in addition to findings from the survey, is that cost is obviously a really significant pressure, right? So the higher the price of fuel, the less likely people are to drive. The higher the cost of maintenance, the less likely people are to drive. But in the same breath, we're also hearing that transit is really expensive across Metro Vancouver. And so we're trying to, you know, play around and hear from people, you know, what would it mean for us to offer free transit? What would that cost look like? How would that actually encourage or shift mode share to transit? Is there kind of like a like an upper limit or a lower limit to transit pricing that would encourage the most number of people in Burnaby to actually access and utilize that particular transportation? Similarly, we're hearing a lot of things around infrastructure development, right? Even is things as simple as like the lack of covered bus shelters is a real disincentive to people taking the bus. In addition to route regularity, right? There's a couple of kind of things where people have said, well, what if we kind of developed a rapid bus system between Metrotown and Lougheed, for example, and really tried to encourage people to move sustainably across the city and move quickly. So, you know, at its core, Danny, this project is really, you know, it's asking the question, how do we make the sustainable choice, the most affordable choice and the most efficient choice for people across the city of Burnaby? How do we achieve that in ways that people who reside and live and work and play and commute through Burnaby, how do we do that in a way that actually brings them along and encourages them to make that choice?
Mm-hmm. You know, I attended one of these workshops last week in Metrotown, and I think one of the prevailing things I heard is that the biggest barrier is that there is still the perception that whether it's biking or public transit, a personal vehicle is always going to be the fastest choice when it comes to getting around. Has this project sort of identified not just, you know, how to sort of reverse that thinking, but also to address that? Because, you know, in a lot of cases, that is the case within Metro Vancouver.
Yeah, it's definitely a prevailing opinion, right? That this idea that cars are going to be, they're going to give me the most flexibility and it's going to be the easiest way for me to get around the city. I think what we're also hearing in those workshops is that people are actually making some really intentional decisions around about how they move around. And it really depends on what their location is and what the purpose of travel is. So we know from our survey results, for example, that people are much more likely to drive if there's going to be a perception of them having to carry heavy things like groceries, for example, right? The people are much less likely to take transit, even if it's the cheaper option and, you know, requires no parking and no stress and anxiety around any of that. Carrying those heavy grocery bags up an escalator and onto the train and then all the way home might be enough of a barrier to encourage car ownership. We're also hearing from people that, you know, depending on where they're going, certain disincentives like limited parking, for example, or a prohibitive cost of parking is actually encouraging people onto transit and onto SkyTrains, right? So those are some of those levers, again, that we're trying to figure out what is the right balance in terms of costing that encourages people to shift towards that more sustainable option. And in the case of other forms of micromobility, what are the types of infrastructure and where would people actually like to see that infrastructure located on their city? So one of the big barriers that we've heard around active transportation, for example, in Burnaby is that we know it tends to be a much younger group of predominantly well-educated men who cycle across the city of Burnaby. We kind of found that that's the case across a lot of different neighborhoods. The question really becomes, okay, well, we know that east-west transportation on bike is pretty good. We also know that Burnaby is pretty hilly, right? So how are we making intentional decisions around where we locate that cycling infrastructure to make it as low barrier as possible? And similarly, what are the right kind of north-south routes to enhance connectivity of Burnaby's existing cycling infrastructure? Because we know that that's a huge barrier to people biking. And the number of times I heard in the last week, you know, I'm on my bike and then I get really frustrated because my bike lane just ends and it spits me out into traffic and there is no real sense of connectivity or sense of a network. That's true not only just when we think about cycling, but when we ask the question, okay, well, if we were biking, how do we make our transportation system in Burnaby as connected as possible across modes, right? So maybe we can't bike the entire way to a destination, but maybe it's about that first and last mile where we might bike to a particular location and that connectivity is actually encouraging connection through other forms of transportation like transit, car sharing, and so on and so forth.
Okay, I think I have one more question to ask. And that would be for those now just hearing about this research project that want to get their voices out there, want to get involved, want to contribute. How can they best do that?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways. So first and foremost, we're hosting a series of workshops across the city right now. And there's a mix of online and in-person workshops. I'd encourage people to check out, if they Google SFU Create, Decarbonizing Transit, you'll find Vahid Hosseini, who's the nominated principal applicant. We have a website on the web for SFU. All of the links for our workshops are listed there. So please, I would encourage your listeners to register, come out, share your opinion with us. We will be hosting other workshops as well in the future. This is just kind of our first kick at the can, but you'll also see us out in the community this summer. We've had lots of invitations from other organizations to come to block parties and community fairs and host a booth and engage people. So we're hoping to have a presence in the community this summer at public events. Beyond that, you can reach out to any of the members of our team, and it would certainly encourage your readership when you find Vahid's website to reach out. If you can't attend those workshops, we're always happy to hear from folks and receive your big, bright ideas by email.
Once again, that was our conversation on the Alternative Urban Transportation Decarbonization Research Project based in Burnaby with Chris Busey, a co-principal investigator with the project, as well as an assistant professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University. To learn more about the project, as well as the team involved, go to sfu.ca's Create page and look for the project titled Decarbonizing Communities on Road Transportation. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.